This episode of Word for Word may contain language or themes that are not suitable for all listeners. If you're experiencing difficulty, please reach out for support. You can reach QLife, an anonymous and free LGBTI support service, by calling 1-800-184-527 or call Lifeline 24 hours a day on 131114 for crisis support and suicide prevention. In an emergency, please call 000.
Australia on the Community Radio Network to over 70 community stations around the nation. This is Word for Word, hosted by Lisa Dano Daniel, coming to you from Australia's LGBTI radio station, Joy.
Hi, welcome to Word for Word. Today's guest has crammed an awful lot into his young life so far. Co-founder and director of Proud to Play, Inc., founding director of Pride Cup Australia, and multi-award winner. Welcome to Word for Word, James Lolicato.
Thank you so much.
How did I go with your surname?
Perfect.
Perfect, great.
Couldn't have done better. And it's funny because everybody pronounces it in two ways. And
really? What's the other one? Both of them.
Lolicato or Lolicato.
Oh, yeah, okay. And Lolicato is right.
Well, it depends where I am in the world.
Okay.
One of them will be right, one of them will be wrong.
Okay, well, let's go with the one I want.
Yeah,
perfect. Because, you know, that makes me right. Now, I want to list your awards and some of the things you've been nominated for.
Okay.
Because... Now, I don't usually talk about people's ages, but you are 26, which
yes.
is pretty incredible. So you are the winner of the Australian Community Leader of the Year Award, in brackets, Australian Employment Index, the winner of Victorian Community Leader of the Year. You were nominated for a Globe LGBTIQ plus Person of the Year in 2018.
Yep.
You were nominated for the Young Achiever Award Australia 2017 and 2018. That's just showing off.
Yes.
Australian Progress Labs Mentor, Melbourne University Accelerator Program Mentor, and you've raised over $1 million for not-for-profit organisations.
Over 1.5 now.
Wow, 1.5.
Yeah. Yes.
You need to update that.
I know.
How does it make you feel when I read that to you in terms of what you've achieved in your life so far?
Oh, embarrassed. I think...
Really embarrassed? Why is that?
A lot of the things was... I always say that luck has like 80% to do with what I've done so far and the career progression that I've kind of had. I kind of came into this space, into the LGBTI inclusion space, at a really good time or a really bad time, depending on which way you look at it. So when I was 21, we kind of just started the huge debate again around marriage equality. I know it's been going on for 25, 30 years, but there was a real big progression over that time of talking about marriage equality. Schools and safe schools especially was getting a lot of heat. So there was a real kind of momentum at that time to start in LGBTI work and to really push forward. And I think a lot of the funders, a lot of the corporates, seeing the growth of Midsummer, seeing the growth of Queer Film Festival, kind of wanted to jump on board and help out. And sport, like, come on, sport has always been the kind of center point of the Australian fabric. And sport was still growing. It was coming from that elite level, kind of, we always need to win, to a participation level. And sporting associations and sporting organisations were looking at how do we get more and more people involved in sport or physical activity. Everything together kind of made it a really good place to be at that time.
What made it a bad time? Because you did say a good time and a bad time.
Well, whenever there's debate around, so my... I had a counselling degree when I first started. So So I was working with a lot of LGBTI youth. So I was speaking at LGBTI youth organisations or local councils usually have LGBTI groups. So I was going and talking to them mostly about like the kind of role that healthy eating or physical activity could have in your everyday life. But what you saw is with that heightened kind of visibility around LGBTI issues also came that other side, which is that heightened negativity around religious freedom or around LGBTI people being wrong or it being something to be upset about or embarrassed about. And then with the rise of the safe schools debates, those young people were getting it so hard because they were turning on the news, which I never did as a young person, but turn on the news and seeing the news talking about negatively LGBTI students and youth.
Sport seems to me to be one of the last bastions of, you know, it's so connected to masculinity in terms of male sport. How do you see it fitting into where we're at in terms of equality?
I think sport is a great tool. There's two ways of thinking about this. So I see sport as a really good tool for social cohesion and equality of all types, especially equity. So talking, we now only use the term equity when talking about how to increase inclusion and diversity, because equity for us means that previous to using equity, people saw that we were giving too much attention to just LGBTI people or too much attention to people who are newly arrived or to multicultural people in sport. And they were saying everybody should be equal, so we should just give the same and then everybody should just run onto the playing field and be at the exact same level. We know that isn't the case, but for sports, they don't always see it that way. So using equity as a kind of justification. So sometimes we have to give people a little bit more so they can end up on that same level playing field that we talk about, even though there's no such thing. But that's...
So what is the difference between equality and equity then?
Equality is the concept that you give everybody exactly the same and imagine them to end on the exact same place. So imagine that when everybody gets the exact same thing, they will kind of just fall into this place where everybody's equal and it's all rainbows and it's all happy. It's not the case. Equity is, we know for a fact that for our trans and gender diverse participants or for LGBTI people living with a disability, sometimes we need to give them a little bit more, be that a ramp as access to get into a venue, heightened education for their peers or their coaches who need to know about what it means to be trans or gender diverse and what facilities they may need. We need to give them that little bit more encouragement, a little bit more education or something else just to make sure that they can end up being on that level playing field and then it can be a really happy place.
So I've heard some people sort of making criticisms that, so it's only a small percentage of the population. Why do we have to make special exemptions or special considerations? What do you say to those people?
Well, you keep adding in those little portions of the population. You keep adding in the 12% of of youth who identifies somewhere in the LGBTI spectrum. That's 12%. That's a huge amount of people, and that's only increasing and increasing. There's figures that say by 2020, it'll be at around 20% of young people under 18 will identify somewhere in the LGBTI spectrum or rainbow. Then you add into that people living with a disability, adding newly arrived refugees, adding people who are multicultural. We're not talking about little portions of our society anymore. We're talking about a huge chunk. Not everybody is pale, male and stale anymore.
Which level of elite sport's doing well, do you think, in terms of equity?
Looking in Victoria, there's a couple of really good examples. We have Cricket Victoria, who has really embedded into their system equity. They've embedded it in a lot of ways. Sport for All, which is their kind of overarching equity space, kind of talks and educates everybody coming into cricket about what it means to be truly inclusive of everybody. Then you look at them on an elite level and they've now hired somebody who's the general manager of inclusion and diversity. They've got a team who specifically focuses on creating better opportunities for people from minority backgrounds. It's something that even 5 or 6 years ago, we never saw in sport. It was just that role might have been put into a high performance role or something else that was currently there. But now they're putting really designated time and roles into this space.
So they may be a little bit behind in terms of the arts and culture and stuff, but sport, you think, is catching up?
Slowly. Then we get things that push us back more and more. But I think that the more as individuals we can push sport to kind of be that change and be that change for good, the more that sport will start seeing that. Sport looks for two things. They look for more people playing and they look for money. We need to show them that it's not just the right thing to do, but it can also get more people playing and it can also get them money.
Is it helpful for, say, organisations like AFL clubs to sponsor queer events or be involved at a kind of monetary level rather than just kind of words?
Definitely. You always need to back up what you're doing with real tangible actions. If that's money, that's great. If that's in-kind contribution, that's even better. You can't just say we're an inclusive club and then never do anything about it.
Yeah, like putting a rainbow sticker on a store or something.
Correct. Putting a rainbow, even though the power of the rainbow is very important, putting a rainbow sticker, just slapping a rainbow on something doesn't make it inclusive. By sponsoring big, large-scale events, by sponsoring little organisations, by giving that in-kind contribution that only they can. For example, I'll use St Kilda Football Club.
Well, that's my team, James. So,
let's
talk about them.
Okay, I'm very happy with St Kilda at the moment. Basically, I can now, or anybody in either of my teams can give them a call and say, hey, we have a young LGBTI person that wants to be involved in football. Can we bring them out to the St Kilda headquarters to come and have a kick with one of the staff? They will say yes. Their first step was marching in Pride March. They put money towards their sporting association actually understanding LGBTI inclusion and diversity with education. And then they took it to that next step and started doing it on a national level, what we see with the Pride game, which is played every year.
In terms of your career, what came first? Was it the, let's have a look, was it Proud to Play or was it Pride Cup?
Proud to Play.
Proud to Play.
Yeah, I founded Proud to Play when I was 21.
21.
Yeah.
So tell me about that. How does that work?
Well, the founding story is kind of cool. It's a really interesting story because for me, I had just, I was in my final year of my psychology degree and I was a counsellor. So I, through my psychology degree, I also got a counselling diploma. What I wanted to do was kind of go and talk to LGBTI youth. Luckily, I had been involved in an LGBTI kind of youth group at a council before. So I spoke to them and I said, I wanted to go speak to the young people there and kind of see what they're doing, if my experiences were very similar to theirs, and just say, do you know what? I went through a lot of shit, but that does change. It can all get better. So kind of wanted to just go in with like a big happy rainbow smile and say, everything gets better, I promise you. Every single one of those youth groups that I went to, there was an underlying thing that really struck their attention. It's when I said to them that I was never involved in sport or any type of physical activity and I left PE class. And every one of them kind of nodded their head. And then as we were telling stories and sharing about one another, every one of them would say, oh, I also left PE. Oh, I also got out of sport. And it got to the point where it was being said so often that I was like, oh my God, I actually think that maybe none of us are being involved in sport or physical activity at all. My partner at the time was also, he was a PhD candidate and he was studying equity in sport, looking mostly at disabilities, so people with an intellectual or physical disability. One thing that he saw from all of his research data, which I'm not good at, so I don't really understand research, but one thing that he saw from his raw data was that everybody who identified as LGBTI wasn't being involved directly in the sport, or most of the clubs had nobody who answered anything to those LGBTI questions. They just did not identify as LGBTI plus or anything outside of the gender binary. So we kind of put those two things together, and one day we're having a few wines at Mum and Dad's kitchen bench, and Mum and Dad were there and we were talking about it. We were kind of sharing our stories. He was sharing the fact that none of his participants in the research identified as LGBTI. I was sharing that every single one of the young people that I was speaking to said they weren't involved in sport or physical activity. And basically we said, all right, well, what can we do?
Where do you get your social conscience from? Because clearly you're helping other people.
Yeah.
Where did you get that from? Are your parents heavily into social justice? Did you grow up in that sort of environment?
Mum and Dad are the nicest people you'll ever meet in your life. Both of them are always first to put other people before themselves. My mum's a hairdresser and she will tell you that she's not a hairdresser.
She's a psychologist.
She's a psychologist. Yeah. That's exactly right. So that's another thing where I think kind of pushed me into psychology, because mum was always like, I'm not a hairdresser. I'm a psychologist that cuts hair. And I was like, okay, that
makes
sense.
Without the expensive education.
Well, that's exactly right.
Learned in the field.
That's exactly right. And dad has just always put others before himself. Always. We had a next door neighbor growing up who was an elderly lady, and dad would be over there every second day helping cook, helping clean, helping take care of the dog, everything. And then would come home and take care of the kids as well.
Are they Italian born, as in?
Correct.
Came
mum was born in Italy.
Yep.
Dad was born in Swanhill.
Do you speak Italian at home? Did you grow up with that?
My grandparents always said to my mum and to us that we need to speak English, because mum was bullied for not speaking English when she first got here. My grandparents kind of came and integrated themselves into the Australian culture and knew that they had to speak English to get around. So for them, it was more important that we learnt English and that we really kind of strengthened our English skills than that we learnt Italian.
I hear that a lot from people both your age and over, like up to my age, that they regret the fact that they didn't speak Italian at home because they were sort of really told not to. What were you like as a little kid in primary school?
Always good. I was always very academic, very studious. I think I was very different to my twin brother, and I like that fact, because when you grow up 4 minutes apart from somebody, literally, sharing the same room, sharing the same birthday presents, like, you can tell I'm a twin because it always comes down to birthday presents. Like, oh, we had to share this. We had to share a puzzle. Every single time it's about sharing a puzzle. I always wanted to make sure that I was different than what my twin was, so people would see us as two individual people, or else everywhere else they'd kind of just say, it's the twins. It's Seven James, which is what was always said.
So not identical?
Not identical, no.
Yeah.
No, fraternal. And I was always a very studious kid. I always wanted to do really well academic-wise, and that was from when I was in primary school to when I was in high school. I still thought the same thing. Academia was kind of the thing that I really wanted to strive for, while my brother did really well in sports. So he had a very different
Your twin
mentality.
Brother?
Yeah, my twin brother. He did really, really well in sports, and also he was quite... He was a gamer, always a gamer, always very pretty social. I was social too, but academia was my main priority.
It's interesting that you sort of you grow up in the same family, but you have such different interests. I'm fascinated by the nature-nurture aspect of humans.
Yeah.
And twins, of course, are fascinating to any psychologist, as you would know from your studies.
Yeah.
At what age do you think you felt really different, like in terms of your sexuality or the sorts of things that you liked?
Well, so... Probably from about 10, we knew we were very different. We have always been best friends. This is the thing. We have always been best friends. At that age, between probably 13 to 16, when I was really struggling with understanding who I was and my sexuality, I think I kind of pulled back from being friends with him. I also pulled back from being friends with a lot of people at high school.
Why do you think you did that?
Because I knew that they weren't going to accept me.
You knew or you suspected?
I suspected. I think I... was telling a story recently to a young group that I was with, and they were like, oh, did you lose friends? And I was thinking back and I thought, do you know what? When I was coming out and prior to coming out, the 3 or 4 years, I kind of feel like I had a mental list in my head of people that would have a tick next to it, people that would have a cross next to it. And those crosses could be because I heard one comment, because I heard one homophobic comment or one thing that was like, oh my goodness, you're not inclusive, or you wouldn't accept me if I was to come out. So I... Now looking back onto it, in hindsight, I kind of pushed them out of my life because I thought that they weren't going to accept me. And for me, that was the easier option, was to push them out.
Do you think we all carry a little bit of internalized homophobia?
Yes. Yes. I think it's innate. We're born with it, especially in sport. I'm always going to come back to sport, but especially in sport, because we are brought up kind of using the word gay as a pejorative for somebody doing bad. Using thinking of women's teams as only lesbians, and that somehow is a negative. Thinking that if you're involved in some sport that is more female rather than masculine, you must be gay. There's all of this kind of innate pressure that's on us as youth, and then we bring that into us being adults.
Do you think that's why we haven't had, to this date, an AFL player, male player, come out?
100%. That's definitely the case. Not until we can find a young person who feels comfortable enough being open about their sexuality at a young level, going through the, let's say, the youth leagues, then going into the state leagues, then going into the elite level, who through that whole session never has to come out because they're just being themselves. They're always out. They're always open. Their family's always there. Their partner's always there. Not until that level will I think that we will see somebody come out.
Because it strikes me that they have to have a fairly thick skin, because they are going to be the poster boy. If we're talking AFL, not AFLW, because there's quite a few out lesbians in AFLW.
Which is awesome.
Yeah, they're really blazing the trail for the men. But I can get where they're coming from, because it's an elite sport, it's a full-time job, it's high pressure, there's lots of mental health issues in AFL, it seems.
And there's sponsorships.
So do they want that added pressure of just, even if they are really confident with their sexuality, do they want the added pressure of the media wanting to interview them for weeks on end? You know, can you imagine the feeding frenzy of the first person coming out?
I remember speaking to Hannah Mouncey just after they had...
Trans AFLW football, yeah.
Correct. Just after they'd kind of gone for the draft and been knocked back from the draft. And Hannah was like, throughout my whole life as a trans person, a trans person was kind of fifth or sixth on the list of who I was. First, I was always a footballer. Secondly, I was a handball player. Third, I was funny. She's not. Well, she's pretty funny. But third, she was funny and comedian. Fourth, she was a great friend. And then fifth, she just so happened to be trans. As soon as it came out that there was a trans woman going for the draft, the first thing that people always kind of recognized Hannah for was the fact that she was trans. And for her, it was really, really hard and so much weight on her shoulders, because how could she be a really good footballer if the first thing everybody's saying is she's trans? There's already that kind of added pressure, or because you have to be the spokesperson for every single trans person in the world, it seems like. And then there's that added kind of negativity around her, because by saying she's a trans footballer, she's not a footballer, she's a trans footballer. And it's kind of what we're doing with AFL women's, in saying they're women's footballers. No, they're bloody footballers.
Look, I can really understand that it would be a distraction for an elite footballer, or elite any sport, to come out, because they will be literally inundated with media requests and profile requests. And, you know, I'd be on their tail for sure, wanting to get them on word for word and that sort of thing.
It's really, I hate that we're just going straight to, well, it'll be bad on the footballer. It really involves the club. It involves the league doing a lot of work around making sure, just as they would anybody else, that they're going to be safe and protected. The club and the league should be the real kind of bearers of all of that media attention, and they should be the ones saying, okay, let him or let her do whatever him or her have to do. They are playing football, and that's what we want them to keep doing. We will answer any questions that you have. Let's just let them play footy. Because at the end of the day, what we'd be doing to them is exactly what happened to Hannah, is they'd be the gay footballer first and foremost, and then there'd be a footballer secondly.
We'd have a booing saga.
Exactly right. That's exactly
right. I love your idea of getting the club to be the ones to be the spokespeople. They have so many media people at clubs, AFL clubs we're still talking here. You know, they can do the talking.
Yeah, they can. And they should. Because just as if, and I'm not comparing the two, but if there is a player who has a mental health problem, you would not expect them to go out in front of media and answer every single question their mental health. No, the club would be protecting them. The club should do that as well with anybody who's coming out as LGBTI. Because firstly, they don't have to come out as LGBTI and they shouldn't have to. I would no way advocate somebody who's not ready to come out. But secondly, when and if they do have the courage to come out and they feel confident enough to do so, the club should back them 100%. And that does involve putting in some embargoes, putting in some barriers to say, let's protect this person and let's not let their skill be denigrated by the fact that they're LGBTI.
What did you think of the recent coming out of Hamish McDonald, the journo from The Project? He does a lot of things.
What was great about that was how casual it was. It was like, hey, here's my partner. Cool. Nobody say anything. Awesome.
And that's the way it should be. Mm. I don't think, do you agree with me that it shouldn't be a press release? Because that makes it seem like a massive issue, and that this person, as you say, Hannah, the trans footballer, you know, then there'd be the gay footballer. Yes, I agree with you. I think it just should be a casual, oh, by the way, I'm going out to this thing and here's my partner.
And do you know who that influences and impacts the most? Is the LGBTI people looking on. Not the other people, not everybody else who's looking on that might have something negative to say. The LGBTI people who, when they see two men hand in hand, they say, oh my God, look at that. That's awesome. Like, this person has so casually come out. They're just being accepted for who they are. And it's so cool. And it's so laid back. And it's so awesome. And that's all we want in life, is to walk down the streets and hold hands with our partners without being vilified against.
So visibility is important, yeah?
So important. Visibility is another reason why we haven't seen any male athletes of our elite sports come out yet, is because there has been no visibility in the past. And like you said, they're scared to be that kind of bearer, that the next big thing.
Are you frustrated by the conflation of gay with questioning masculinity? Because that seems to me to be one of the risks that people that don't know enough about this think, that, oh, if he's gay, he's not masculine enough.
Yeah.
How ridiculous.
In sport, hypermasculinity, as in male sports, let me just say, hypermasculinity is something that's looked at as being really cool. The more masculine you are, probably the cooler you will be, or the more young people will look up to you, is what it seems like is happening. And then the fact that you're gay might mean that you're not seen as being as hypermasculine or as masculine. It's not the case. It's not always the case. I think when we see our first kind of footballers, or when we see our first male elite level athletes come out, we will see an instant change in that feeling, because somebody that you've looked at up to all your life as being someone who's masculine and there's nothing different than them and their other teammates, it just so happens to be gay.
I kind of think that the concept of masculinity is changing a lot in a arena like AFL, because, I mean, it used to be very, I remember watching football in the 70s and was short shorts and hairiness, which is in itself was kind of homoerotic. But, you know, AFL football is now seen to be the trendsetters in fashion and hair and manscaping. And, you know, that's sort of at odds with the traditional idea of masculinity. I love the fact that all of that isn't being embraced.
Yeah, exactly. Even mental health has been looked at before as being something that's not as masculine, if you're admitting that you have mental health problems, or admitting that you want to support someone with mental health problems. And now we've seen players come out and say, do you know what, I do have a mental health problem, and their leagues and their clubs are jumping behind them and saying, okay, we'll support you, and they're getting really big round of applauses from all of their social media followings and people. They're not seeing them as being sissies. They're seeing them as being so strong and so masculine that they're so proud of themselves and can be so brave and come out and say, look, I have a mental health problem, and I need some help. And that's awesome.
So take me back to your teenage years when you were... So when we were talking about that before, you said you kind of withdrew a little bit from your twin brother and friends. Do you think people around you noticed that you'd step back a little bit?
I think that Mum definitely did. So Mum seems to think, looking in hindsight, that she knew everything that was going on all the time. But I think that Mum knew what was going on, not in the fact that I was LGBTI, but maybe the fact that I had withdrawn and was kind of hanging at the back, hanging in the library. I stopped going to PE altogether. For me...
Did you give a reason for that?
Mum knew that I was body conscious to begin with. So especially when swimming came around, she knew that that was the reason why I didn't want to swim. The other reason was there was so much homophobic comments. I felt like it was the one place at school where I could be called gay because I was a little bit effeminate and nobody would ever pick anybody up on it, and teachers could even get involved and say it. And teachers were saying it. Teachers were using gay as a pejorative. Teachers were saying homophobic comments on the fields, and nobody would ever be pulled up on it.
It's not that long ago, given you're only 26.
No. When did I graduate? What, 9 years ago? So it's really not that long ago that this was all happening. To be fair, everywhere else in school that I was, if there was a homophobic comment that was made, it was instantly kind of pulled up on. Somebody would say, no, don't say that. Detention, suspension, whatever it was, depending on kind of the level of the homophobia, they would be pulled up on it. But in PE, it was the one place where it seemed like everybody could get away with it because it was just part of the game. And if anybody said anything, it's just like, oh, no, just part of the game. Stop being a wussy. But it's when it's coming from your own team and when it's coming from your teachers as well. That's when it's like, oh, okay. This is where it's too much for me and where I need to kind of just stop going. And for me, like I said, academia was so important. So my whole life was in academia because I wasn't getting any sport. I wasn't getting any physical activity. And when I went home, I didn't want to be involved in any type of outside sport because I'd had this such negative experience in sport in school. So I didn't want to go into a team that might not accept me.
So when did that start changing for you?
So just after the end of year 12, my brother and his best friends kind of accepted me onto their basketball team. And I was openly gay at that time. And they accepted me on. They let me know that they didn't care who I was, which is kind of what we want to hear. Like, they didn't make the fact that I was gay that first thing. They just wanted me to be a good basketballer. I never was that good. Like, I wasn't that good. But for my brother and his friends, who are still some of my best friends today, they brought me onto this basketball team and made me so accepted and included. When I used to share this story in youth groups, they would kind of look at me with like huge smiles on their faces, being like, oh, is that a real story? And I'd be like, it's 100% real. Like, this is what happened to me. I didn't even know that I wanted to be involved in sport. When I was, it was so awesome. Every single Friday night was spent playing basketball at the local basketball stadium. And I was with my brother, who was my best friend, but I was also with five new mates that were awesome. We would go out afterwards and go get food or go get drinks. I made new best friends out of the process that I would have never had. And I kind of looked back and thought, oh my God, did I miss out on that whole experience from when I was 16 onwards because I was scared of what was going on?
Because often I played a lot of sport when I was young, up until I was about nearly 40. And sport to me was like an alternative family.
Yep.
Being, and particularly a team sport, I think a team sport is should almost be compulsory for kids, but I know that I'm just being facetious because it doesn't suit everyone. But it's such a great little collegiate thing to be involved in. And for those people who you know, are queer and not wanting to be involved, it's a sad loss, really. So who did you come out to first once you started to get that confidence?
My best friend at the time. So what happened was I was in a relationship for 3 years. I wouldn't call it a relationship. It's like, you know, that first kind of friendship that turns a little bit
special.
Yeah, that's exactly what it was. And first it turns a little bit special as it started at school, then it turned a little bit special. And then I kind of, it ended. And it ended because they started seeing somebody else, a female. And I remember that at that point, I had nobody to protect anymore. So before that, I couldn't come out because I felt like I had to protect this person. We were so close that if I came out, people would instantly be like, oh my goodness, they're definitely together.
Were there rumours around you too?
There was always rumours. Nevertheless, it was, I think people just kind of laughed it off. Nobody thought it was real. It was just kind of how we make jokes about everything. Again, that innate culture is if two men are too close to each other, they must be gay. And well, in this case, they were probably right. When that ended, I remember calling my best friend. I'm like, oh, I've got something to tell you. And he's like, what's happened? And I was like, oh, can we meet up? And he met me and took me for a drive to the beach. So I always had a favourite part of the beach where I did my thinking, which is at the end of North Road. There's a few rocks there.
I know that beach, yep.
Yes. And you look over the city. And we were sitting there and I remember just telling him and just saying it. Like, nothing. I didn't care. I was kind of sitting outside of my body at that time and I was watching myself tell him and there was no reaction. He did not care at all. He didn't know. It wasn't something that he was totally aware of, but he kind of just listened. And I said everything that had happened. I told him about my first feelings. I told him about this guy. I told him he knew who it was, so there was other things that was going on. And then we were kind of just there, and I could talk for the first time. I think the next question was, so what's next? Like, who are we telling next? That same night, he came to my house. And he told my mum for me.
He told your mum?
Yes.
What, were you standing there?
I was standing there. He said to my mum, James has something to tell you. And mum's like, oh no, did you get somebody pregnant? So mum knew she was just being facetious in it and she was just making a little joke. And mum's like, just tell me. And I was like, I cannot say the words to you. Like, I'd blocked these words for so long that I could not say because I felt so guilty telling mum because I've always told my mum everything. And this one thing I didn't tell her, so I felt really guilty, which is a stupid thing to feel.
That's interesting that you felt guilty because you hadn't told her rather than you felt guilty that it might upset her.
I knew it wasn't going to upset her. She's a hairdresser. Like, she's helped people who have come out as gay. Her best friend growing up was gay. Like, she's always had these people around her life. So I knew she was going to accept me, but that wasn't what it was. For me, at that moment, it was I felt really guilty saying those words to her that I hadn't said, even though that I've known them for 10 years.
So why hadn't you told her before that, do you think?
I have no idea. And you kind of look back on it now, after this has all been done for 7 years, you look back on it and you're just like, oh, why didn't I do that? There was nothing that was holding me back. It could have been school. I went to an all-Catholic boys' school. It could have been the fact that I didn't want to hurt my grandparents. When I was 16... I knew that I would move overseas. And when I moved overseas, I would come out over the phone. And that would be so easy. And that would be the best way. And then if everybody was angry at me, it's fine because I'm overseas. So I don't have to be involved in that. Because of the circumstances and what had happened. And then I just kind of cracked and came out to my friend. And then we're back talking to mum. And when we're back talking to mum, when mum said those words, like, just tell me, I freaked out and kind of went into a ball and didn't talk. And then my friend just goes, James is gay. And mum's like, and I know this. And those were the words.
What do you want for dinner?
Yeah, that's exactly right. Nothing's changed. And nothing did change. From there, it was just a domino effect.
Do you think that's a perfect reaction when people are just kind of nonplussed?
It's exactly what I wanted. Exactly what I wanted. I didn't want there to be a big clap. I didn't want there to be ovation. I didn't want there to be sadness or tears. I just wanted them to be like, okay, cool. Nothing is changing.
I always get amused when you tell someone, usually an acquaintance or something, or someone you meet in, I don't know, retail or something, and you mention your partner or your sexuality, and they go, oh, that's so cool.
Yeah.
It's like, no, it just is. Yeah. Like, it's like saying my nose is cool or, you know, it's just yeah. It's just weird.
No, this is, it's just
you
us.
Just want you just want nonplussed.
Yeah.
It's, you know, it's an important part of you, but it's not the be-all and end-all. It's not, you know, it just seems really odd.
Well, I mean, I was booking a flight the other day, and I was booking it for me and my partner, and they said to me, oh, what's his name? And I hadn't said anything about my sexuality. Obviously, I hadn't come out to my travel agent on the phone.
No.
I hadn't said anything. I didn't mind the fact that it was assumed. What I loved is that they were just like, what's his name? It was just part of the conversation, and that has become part of someone's vernacular, which is just, hey, what is their name? What is his name? It's not just assumed that it's a female, or what's their name kind of thing. Like, who are they? Is it a boy or a girl? It was just like, what's his name? And
I've had experiences where I've actually said my partner's female name, you know, her name several times, and the person will still say, oh, yes, tell your husband, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. It's like, how many times have I said this girl's name? It's clearly a girl's name.
Yeah.
They just hear what they want to hear.
A lot of people do. Yeah.
When did you tell your father and your twin brother?
I have a feeling that when mum and dad went to bed that night, that she told him already. But because I woke up and he was kind of like there. Or what I remember is I was eating breakfast and he was kind of there over my shoulder, just looking at me, like waiting with a smile on his face, like waiting for me to come out. And I was just like, okay. And then I told dad, I was like, Dad, mum's obviously already told you, but I'm gay. And dad's like, yes, I know. I know. And I was like, cool. And he's like, how good's this? Like, we can talk openly about it. Are you seeing anybody? And I was like, I'm not ready to talk about that.
It's nice to have that curiosity, though.
Yeah.
It's nice that they just go, yeah, that's fine, and then just never refer to it again, which I hear has happened to people.
Well, what I remember as
which is a form of judgment in itself.
It is. What I remember now thinking about it is, and Dad told me this after I came out, is he'd been subtly kind of saying when we were all in the car together, like going to basketball, or he would drop us off at basketball, or going to trips, Dad would be like, oh, so-and-so came out and it's so awesome, or if any of you have anything to tell me, I would just love if you told me, because it would mean nothing to me. Like, you know that I love you for whoever you are, and would always have these little remarks. And of course, I did note them in my head, and I knew that that's what he was getting at, but I was like, not ready, not ready yet. But I think that Dad even doing that really helped.
Yeah, you set the scene for an expectation that you could have that it's going to be a safe place.
And it's when you asked me, were you worried? Never worried. Never once worried about what my parents would say.
But worried at school, clearly.
Well, very. Yeah. Very. I'm worried in other areas as well, because worried with my grandparents, what they might say. Being both born in Italy, they hadn't known anybody LGBTI. Oh, well, I thought they hadn't, because I'd never spoken to them about it. Little did I find out later on when I came out to them that one of my grandfather's best friends, who he used to do French polishing for, because that was his occupation, had a husband. But my grandpa never made that well known. It was just him and his partner. And I just never thought anything different.
And what was their response when you did finally come out to them?
My grandfather kind of, it took a few moments, I think, for him to realize, because he still said to me once, but you'll still marry a girl. And I was like, no. It doesn't work that way. He's like, oh, but it can change. No, it doesn't work that way. Okay, cool. And that's what it took him to understand that this isn't a choice. And mum did help out a lot with that translation barrier. So mum spoke to him a lot, like, this is not a choice. This is him. This is who he's always been. And tomorrow you're about to meet his partner. Because that was a couple of years after I came out to mum and dad. And then the next day they met my partner. To that day, like to this day, I've had two different partners since I've come out to them, and my current partner is Italian and speaks fluent Italian, and they love him more than anything else in the world, which is really annoying because they love him more than they love me. So the first question that whenever I go to their house, the first question they ask is, how's Daniel? It's like, oh, he's good, but what about me? Speak to me. But they've really kind of just accepted him as they would any other partner, and his family now is so integrated with my family, including his grandparents and my grandparents, that it's just like everybody else would be. My grandpa will introduce my partner to his friends as my partner. I thought he would say this is his friend, or
yeah,
this
just
is
avoid it.
This is, yeah, or just not say anything, but talks about it, introduces it, talks about his family and how much he loves them to his friends and his family as well, which I never thought would happen.
So it's great to have the investment of both your respective families.
Mm-hmm, yes.
Do you think it helps a relationship?
Yeah, definitely. I couldn't imagine being so close to my family, what it would be like to be dating somebody who maybe didn't get that support from their family. For me, it just helps out a lot with how close I am with my family. I would love that same kind of morals with them and their family too.
Well, it's the icing on the cake, isn't it? If you're not running around hiding from one family,
yeah,
and the other family's accepting, the other one's not, or they just don't know. It just makes it a lot easier for everyone to just be who they are.
Yeah, I think as LGBTI people, we're so sick of hiding, sick of being behind the barriers or in the closet. Every single time now that I need to hide again or need to be in the closet, I just refuse to do it. I really cannot, don't have that emotional strength now to kind of put myself back into a closet after I've already come out.
Does that happen very often? Do you find yourself in situations where you feel not safe to be who you are?
No, only because my work is literally being LGBTI. And I've thought about this before, because in sport I shouldn't be able to be so open about the fact that I'm gay. I need to be, because I'm going and sharing my experiences with sporting organisations as an LGBTI person, not as an ally, not as someone who's like heterosexual. I'm going in and speaking as a gay man to these sporting organisations, which first and foremost is really important, because to get that first step into a sporting organisation as a gay man can be really hard. And I'm bypassing all of that, and again, doing what I said, young kind of footy players, when we get our first openly gay football player, there will be somebody who's always been open, just been unapologetic about it. That's kind of what I want to do in these sporting associations, is just go in and just talk about my boyfriend, talk about the fact that I'm openly gay, or talk about my experiences.
Tell me about a week in your job. What sort of things do you get up to as part of your job at Pride Cup?
I'll use last week as an example. On Saturday, we were in Gippsland, woke up at 5 a.m., went down to Gippsland in the morning.
That's when the sport is.
Well, that's
the weekends,
it. Yes. That's it. So woke up at 5 a.m., went down to Gippsland with my co-worker, Cara, and we were at the first ever Gippsland Roller Derby Pride Cup. By the time we got there, which was probably 7 a.m., there was 150 people there. We sold rainbow merchandise, and all the money from that rainbow merchandise goes back into supporting other Pride Cups. I was the MC at that event, so I was lucky enough to welcome the local LGBTI group as well as the local mayor, and then welcome the game as well for the day, which is awesome. That game was absolutely incredible. And then that night was the gala of that game, so they ended up doing an extended celebration. Then Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday is my days at Pride Cup, and that is full on. So it's answering emails and phone calls from the 55 clubs that we have around Australia running Pride Cups this year, but it's also trying to raise as much money as possible for all of those clubs, as well as the organisation, to keep thriving and keep growing stronger and stronger.
Do organisations contact you about being involved in Pride Cup, or do you do outreach, or both?
Both. So sporting clubs and associations will usually contact us and say, we want to do this, usually because they have invested interests. So they might have a gay player, they might have a community member who's part of their club who's gay, and they want to support it. So they will contact us and say, what are the next steps? And we walk them through a big process. Organisations who want to donate, we usually go to. So we're always looking for somebody to help donate to this cause and to raise money with, or in-kind contribution and support, to see how we can further support all of these sporting clubs across the country. Right now, they're all paying for their own events. We want to make sure that they can at least get some subsidies when they're running these events, because it's really important, especially in regional and rural areas. It's really important that they're doing that.
When you're doing outreach to clubs, so are you virtually cold calling clubs?
No. So at least twice a week, we will have some type of public forum. So be that speaking at a LGA, so a local council, or speaking at a league event, speaking in front of hundreds of people at a forum, something along those lines, where we can go out, tell the story of Pride Cup, tell them what we do, and try and get people's hearts and minds into running a Pride Cup. So then they can sign up online to making the next step in that process.
Do you get much pushback from clubs?
We used to. Now, I can't remember, except for last week, there was one incident with umpires not wanting to be involved, but we were able to use education tools to kind of counter that, so talk to them about what this game meant and why it was important. We also had other people on call on standby, just in case they said no, we could get other umpires that we've worked with who we know want to do this.
What were their reasons for not wanting to be involved? And what was it, that they didn't want to wear rainbow socks, or what was the...
In this circumstance, they didn't want to be part... They didn't want to be so visible. They did the old, we're not homophobic, but. Mm. Yeah, and it's that but, and what comes after that's really important. But they didn't want to be very visible in kind of their support for LGBTI inclusion and awareness, just in case somebody saw them.
Because someone might think they're gay as well?
Somebody might think they're gay or a sissy. Or not masculine enough.
How do you go about talking to them?
Once they hear real life stories about LGBTI people being involved in sport, once they hear about the rates of people trying to end their own lives, people being successful in ending their own lives, once they hear about the type of population and how many bloody people there are who just want to be involved in sport but can't get in, they change their minds. And you can see on their faces when they change their minds. You just have to say to them that we have almost 15% of our population that's identifying as LGBTIQ, and almost it's about 90 or so percent aren't being involved in sport or physical activity. Like, your club's struggling and we want to help you. We want to come in and get you more volunteers. We want to come in and get you more players. And it's also the right thing to do, because we also have 1 in 2 trans people at some stage will attempt suicide in their life. We know that sport is such a great tool to making sure that never has to happen. The trans people that you know in your life, the LGBTI people that you know in your life, you don't want to lose them. And we know that. And we can do what we can by just getting them involved in sport and wearing our rainbow socks for one day, and saying that we support LGBTI people and want them as part of our club. And you'll usually see them turn around and just be like, okay, we get it. We understand. But we needed to know that, because a lot of the times they don't know that. They think it's a political awareness activity. And that's the last thing we want to do, is get involved in politics.
Yeah, no, I sort of hear pushback in terms of, oh, we feel like we're getting social engineering shoved down our throats, or let kids be kids, or, that sort of argument.
Yeah, let kids be kids when it's good for them, but not when the kids just so happen to be trans and they're not being involved in any sport or physical activity and we won't let them. I don't understand those arguments.
So I want to talk to you a little bit about Israel Folau, because it's very topical.
Yes.
So we've recently had Israel Folau in the news in terms of religious freedoms and protecting those. What is your response to people who say, well, if they're religious, they should just be able to say anything in terms of free speech?
So there's a very big difference between free speech and hate speech. What we see in cases like this, where somebody can just say everybody's going to hell, where somebody can literally, that's violence. It's violence. It's them wanting people to die because of who they are. What we see is that people are hiding their hate speech by saying it's free speech. And for some reason, they're getting away with it. In Australia, we don't have a constitution that says everybody's allowed to have free speech, firstly. Everybody should be allowed to say what they think. That is extremely important to do. But you shouldn't denigrate people on the way to doing that.
We should acknowledge there's consequences.
There is consequences. I think that this isn't free speech, it is hate speech. Someone like Israel Folau is really good at it. He's a master manipulator in the fact that he has a really good kind of community behind him that's saying, yeah, this is such free speech, this is all free speech. But when you look at the facts of it, when you look at him saying that LGBTI people should go to hell, that trans kids aren't real kids, all of the things that he's said over the past 2 years, and it hasn't just been one exchange. I don't think a lot of people realise that it's been over a 2-year period.
He's been warned at least a couple of times.
He's been warned a lot of times. He is single-handedly making sure that people aren't being involved in sport, and that he's increasing the statistics. One thing that a lot of people don't understand is that when you make these comments and people see them, you're hurting kids. You are hurting a lot of kids. 12% of our population are looking onto these comments that is being made and thinking that they're not accepted, or thinking that they're not good enough to live. And for that, that's only increasing the statistics that we see each and every day. And the arguments that people are making around free speech are wrong, or around the fact that breach of contract. Yes, he breached his contract, but that's the wrong argument to make. What we should be saying is, what you're doing is you're adding to the statistics. Young people who God tells us we need to treat equally and we need to give everything that we can to, young people will be kind of attempting to end their own lives because of direct things that he's said. And we're not focusing on that. I don't know why we're not focusing on that, because that is what will get people to instantly shut the hell up and kind of stop saying this is free speech, because free speech cannot involve hurting somebody else.
No, it's kind of like, where do you draw the line with free speech? Do you say that, oh, I can, talk about child sex abuse, or, I can talk about that as if I like it, or,
Yeah.
I mean, where do you draw the line with these things? Words do have consequences, as you know, and someone as visible as that has so much power, they don't seem to realise, but of course he does realise, because he started a GoFundMe campaign, until it was shut down, was reasonably successful.
I was shocked at how successful that GoFundMe was. But again, it's because of that messaging that him and his supporters have put out. Again, talking just about free speech, and where, as allies to the LGBTI community, as LGBTI members, as sporting players and people, we're not putting out the right message saying that this is hurting people and this is killing people.
Are you concerned that we've recently elected a Conservative government which is headed by a Pentecostal Christian?
Every single day. I think it's hard not to be concerned. And as well, we look at even funding for the two organisations, for Pride Cup and Proud to Play, and what we were projecting was going to be great years coming up over the next 3 or 4 years. We have now had to drastically kind of think about where we're going to be getting money from, where we're going to be getting our resources from, because we can no longer count on federal government to sponsor us. Where we thought we would have a really good chance previously, now we can't even look at that. So it's not just the fact that they're spreading messages that are terribly terrifying. They're trying to push across religious exemption acts that are so wrong and are just going to what we talked about before, just going to increase the statistics. But they're also now not going to fund organisations who can help kind of negate those negative consequences and make them positive. So there's a lot of things that we have to look at. It's not just about what messaging is getting shared by this government. It's also about where are we going to find funding for things that we've done for 15, 20 years in the past. Where are you going to find funding for it now?
It's kind of unfortunate, but in a way, it's kind of good in terms of a wake-up call, because I think when we got equal marriage, everyone just went, oh, you know, a lot of people just went, oh, you've got the equal marriage now. Mm-hmm. You can just kind of relax and that's it. And there's, you know, inequality is gone.
Yeah.
I mean, how ridiculous.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, in some ways it's a good wake-up call that we still have to fight the fight, and there is no complete equity or equality.
Yeah.
And organisations like yours still have a huge role to play.
Well, not until we can have... Not until being gay isn't the biggest thing about somebody. Not until being trans isn't the biggest thing and people are calling us saying, how the hell do we get a trans... Like, how do we sign this trans person up to our club? We don't know what's going on. Are we going to be vilified against? Are we going to get media coming in? Literally is questions that we get asked. Like, is the Herald Sun going to come in and do an expose on us because we have one trans person under the age of 10 who's playing in our club? Like, no. Until those kind of fears are over, until we stop hearing homophobic comments, until we get down those statistics, until we save lives and help, like, LGBTI youth especially just grow up in a really equitable society where they don't ever have to worry about these things, will we stop the fight? Marriage equality was great. It was incredible. At the end of the day, LGBTI people still don't have the rights.
It's a small step, really.
Yeah, it's a
small
step. Oh, it was a bloody great step. Yeah. Expensive step, but a really, really, really good step to have. And I think that did also kickstart a lot of the, especially corporate sponsorship to what we're seeing in LGBTI initiatives, that kickstarted that because people did see that there was 65%, why did I forget this, of the population who said yes, and this is 65% of the population they can target in advertising. And for them, that means more money. But it's also doing the right thing at the same time.
Yeah, it's kind of, you know, in a way, sort of talking about it in a money sense makes me feel uncomfortable. But of course, money talks.
Yeah.
And if they're doing it for that reason, but also because it's the right thing to do, well...
And it needs to be both. It can't be one or the other.
Yeah.
Especially with organisations, they can't just do something because it's the right thing to do. Because as an organisation, there's somebody else who will say, no, this isn't right. No, this isn't good enough. There's that male, pale, stale kind of elite level people who are overlooking them that will say, nope, not doing this. It doesn't make money.
So the aim of Pride Cup, really, the not-for-profit, is to see itself out of existence, isn't it?
Yeah. It's to increase visibility so much on rural and regional sporting fields that you won't have to see that visibility anymore because it's already been done.
What happens next for you? You're going to stick this out for a while?
Yeah.
Give me a 5-year plan for James.
The next focus with Proud to Play especially, and my work that I'm doing with Proud to Play, so I still work there one day a week, but it's more like 3 days a week with all of the work that I'm putting behind it, is to make sure that trans and gender diverse people have the rights to participate in sports on all levels, and to really make sure that Australia is pushing to be the first and forefront in trans and gender diverse inclusion and equity within our sports. I think that it is something that has, until maybe a year ago, never been looked at. And Australia has been so reactive in their stance. I want to make sure that everybody's proactive so nobody's ever again fighting for just allowing themselves to be a player or to be a volunteer. They can just be involved and they no longer have to fight for themselves. People have done the fighting for them, and now they can just go and not have to worry about being involved in anything because they know they're going to be accepted and included.
Well, James, you've been fighting for us. And you're still 26 and you've done so much and you've contributed so much. Your family must be very proud of you. Thank you for coming in and talking to me about all of the stuff that you do for the LGBTIQ community. And good luck with the next Pride Cup. Yeah, thank you so much for everything you do for our community.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you for this therapy session.
Thanks, James. Cheers. I'll check some mail. Cheers.
Word for Word is presented and produced by Lisa Daniel, with production support by Chris Tate from Australia's LGBTI radio station, Joy. Word for Word is distributed nationally to over 70 stations across the community radio network.
If you're experiencing difficulty, please reach out for support. You can reach QLife, an anonymous and free LGBTI support service, by calling 1800 184 527 or call Lifeline 24 hours a day on 13 11 14 for crisis support and suicide prevention. In an emergency, please call 000.